The meadowlark and the chimtree and the sparrow said to the sky in a flying spree for the sport of the pharaoh. Little while later, the Pharisees dragged a comb to you and me in our window. There is a rusty light on the pines tonight, some corn wine, Lord Romero. Into the bones of the birches and the spires of the churches jutting out from the shadow. The oak and the axe and the old smokestacks and the bale and the barrow. And everything sloped like it was dragged from a rope in the mouth of the south below. We've seen those mountains kneeling,
listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void. Time passed. My days fell into the comfortable rhythms of routine. I woke, spent my day in Tristram Battlebane's silent company, and at night I went out for my evening observation of Sherwin. This included simply following him home from the theater, and then entering his apartment and watching over him until he fell asleep. Then a slow walk back to Claridge House at 70 Windsor. I was never alone during my nightly vigil. The stalwart, Cassidy, was always lurking close by. But now that I respected the arrangement of distance between Sherwin and myself, Cassidy remained an unseen referee of the dark shadows. Whereas not much changed in the routine fact of my days, I cannot stress enough the profound but subtle shift that was taking place in the core of my being. And perhaps that isn't even quite accurate, as really, the shift was one of perspective. Quite simply, with each night's transit and bedside observation, I felt myself to be less and less Sherwin Sleeves. I detached further and further my association with him, until the queer moments arrived when I realized that I thought of the man before me as Sherwin Sleeves, with fullest exclusion and no strings attached. If I thought of myself at all, it was in the negation of this, as in, I am not Sherwin Sleeves. I did not recognize the fact of this shifted perspective. In some ways, I was increasingly disposed to a kind of thoughtless bedazzlement. It was as though enough strange things were going on, and doing so in the most pedestrian fashion, that I was no longer able to preserve my train of thought. In retrospect, I may say that I was primarily feeling things rather than thinking about them. And by that, I don't mean I was in a state of high emotion. More like, as I ate lunch, I was aware of the qualities associated with the process of eating, the taste of the food, the softness of the bread, the coldness or warmness of my drink, the taste of the tomato or the texture of a roast. A great feature of my overall experience now related to what felt like an influx of nothingness. I literally was becoming like a houseplant or piece of furniture. I was, of course, alive. I ate and drank and felt things. I moved about here and there, sometimes with purpose, sometimes without. But I had lost that loud accompaniment I had grown so used to. There was no stampede of inner conversation. It was as though I had suddenly been transported from the hammering symphony of the city to the tender silence of the forest. This lack of inner noise was startling to me at first, and it was joined, strangely, by a sensation of an imminent boredom. But despite the fact that nothing was occupying my attention, boredom did not come. Another feeling that I may put a name to now was the feeling that I was no longer in charge, in the way that one breathes without effort, without the command to do so. I was living along the wind of life. As the blood moved through my body, as my heart pumped and my breath grew and fell away, so too was I falling into the universal automatica. It was not me that was finally on top of the entire system and running it all, the master puppeteer. No, the system, the universe itself, was running me. Other feelings came. I was aware of certain old pleasures, certain old pains floating through me like canoes I'd carved in the woods of my dreams, certain excitements and moments of epiphany from my younger life. I recalled in my sensory way the story experience that attended the small pond lurking in the woods behind my elementary school. We children were, of course, forbidden to visit it. The groundskeeper could often be seen shaking handfuls of grass over the slick, muddy groove our children's feet had cut at the forest edge. But nothing could be done to the shadowy curtain our swiping arms had created in the tree branches, which now strained importantly for closure over the trail. This dark crevice in the greenery, this little cave door opening in the hedge where a child's eye automatically went, was the gateway to a magic land. During the recess periods, there was often a patrolling teacher monitoring the secret entrance. But when there was not, I would try to make a break for it. Especially on those chilly or drizzly days the teachers wrongly construed as contractive to such expeditions. Inclement weather to me, however, meant an almost certain pilgrimage to the pond. From grades 1 through 6, I was able to secure an almost weekly vacation to the magic land, and it was only toward the later grades, perhaps 5th or 6th, that I finally was able to notice the very vast birch tree growing invisibly silver into the sky from the pond center, not 15 feet from the mossy pile of rocks where I commonly rested. Like a torn sliver in a movie screen, it sundered the panorama. And yet, I had never seen it. How could it be, I wondered, that I had come to my pond so regularly and failed to see this most present being? It was so obvious to me now that I'd seen it, this great tree galumphing in the center of the pond, that I became agitated by a creeping awareness that the world must not be as plainly accessible as I had once thought. If I had not seen this obvious tree, what else was I missing? I experienced this as a kind of tingling and pleasant awareness of truth. One of the formidable eccentricities I cultivated as a child was the way in which I attempted to establish protocols for my future way of being. I thus had a list of behaviors I would try to emulate, moods I would try to avoid. I promised myself that I would always keep a clean room and always try to save money where I could. I would walk and sit with a confidently erect posture. My handshake would be firm to the point of overstrong, and I would look my fellows directly in the eye, as though in slight challenge to their authority. I would not be nasty to children, but neither would I engage them in that saccharine and patronizing way I so often saw at the local church. I would not laugh in public, or I might discreetly, if polity required. I would hold doors for all those that I could, and be appreciative if anyone held a door for me. I would not allow myself to express the ugly emotions of anger or sadness, but I would allow myself to explore the murky depths of that middle ground emotional sorrow, of melancholy. I could explore the yearning tones of my own loneliness, so long as I might keep myself intact and unfluttered. The lesson I'd learned from the discovery of the obvious but long unseen tree was thus drafted into my list of protocols, my way of being. I promised myself that I would always look at things a little deeper, and even self-promote a clear awareness of the imperfection of my assembly view of the world. What I thought was true was not necessarily true, and I wanted to remember that. To know that I did not know. This was what I hoped to take with me. And now, decades and decades later, the epiphany of the pond and the tree returned. And along with it, I felt the metal gloves of my old protocols. How hard I'd been on myself, starting even then as a boy with my cold and fearful list of rules. Watching show in every night and discovering that I was not, after all, him, was really just the most recent way of seeing the secret tree in the center of the pond. Something had allowed my perspective to change just enough to allow for clear sight. I found my true self then and there, a body alive, standing in the dark shadows, in the pure, simple, unadorned, unmemorable, but beautiful experience of the moment by moment, of the delicate rotary of one breath after another. The tall city buildings lay down against the distant sky in their painter's pose. I have noted how these skyscrapers fail to exist in the medium distance. One either sees them from very far away, or from the tight frame of their footed base. Somehow, the zenith and tangle of their height is obscured by the very nature of a city, wherein one realizes that the roads and alleys one trods are nothing but deep valleys cut in a glass and stone canyon. That one is no longer on the surface of the earth, but submerged in a heavy-handed construction of built-up things. To return from my visit with Sherwin to my new residence at Claridge House, I had to head back the way I came. There was no shortcut, which meant I would pass by way of the Gresham Park, where I would sit at some distance from the Pontiac Vendago Theater and smoke one of my 11 prescribed cigarettes on one of the growingly cold and dewy benches near the duck pond. I should say here that it was increasingly clear just how exceptional and talented a smoker I'd become. I was fully aboard and vigorously absorbed by my new habit. I found myself trying to imagine expanding this 11 cigarette limit through some petition to Tristram Battlebane. However, we were still living together in silence, and I felt that it might be best to actually discuss the matter aloud with her, rather than by way of one of our little notes, which was so incompatible with subtlety. I continued under the impression that at any moment she would lift the prohibition on the spoken word, and yet, some time later, we were still, Tristram and I, communicating in this mute, pen-and-paper way. Mostly, it was Tristram writing to me. Interestingly, her notes were either very plain and bossy, as in, "Get dressed, time for breakfast, wear the red tie and black shoes I've set out," or they were grossly enigmatic, as in the very blank and very non-directed note she'd given me this morning, which read, "What do you think of it?" I looked gamely around the room and at her, but could find no obviously different thing which may have undergone a change, and which might sponsor, therefore, some opinion in me as to the difference. Every day I could count on at least one of these riddle notes. The most provocative one read, "Something occurred, and just went back." And at the time of its transmission to me, Tristram seemed to be indicating, by her expressive and obviously ongoing thrill, as though she were listening to some barely detectable deep water music, that if I could only notice this something that had occurred, that I would also be able to appreciate how swimmingly well it had gone back, and therein, within this shift, be able to join her in her regard of it. My own responses to her were, more often than not, simple gestures. Usually I just nodded my agreement, as in, "Yes, I will wear the tie and shoes you've set out to breakfast." But to her riddling notes, I either looked unctuously back at her as though it was hoped that soon, somehow, my thick skull would be penetrated by the mystery of her words, or I would shrug with a little anxious venom, expressing, at least to a degree, how inappropriate it was to be so vague and incomplete and flatly mystifying with someone you'd never actually spoken to. What was the point of these, I wondered. If I knew her, perhaps I might assign some appropriate value to the messages. Maybe she was a terribly light-hearted woman, always pushing forward the surrealist joke. Or maybe she was serious and deeply wise and noted things in the room or the world that I was too dull to appreciate. But after a time, I settled somewhat and began to consider them as they were, unsolvable riddles. Thus I did, during my nighttime wanders after watching Sherwin fall asleep, go over my body reaction to such phrases as, "What do you think of it?" and "Something occurred and just went back." The unpleasant buzzing of confusion from my inability to come up with any answer soon became a rather gratifying and restful escort to peace and disillusion. Like mad rivers commending themselves into the ocean, these riddles exploded into a vast nowhere and stranded me there, and the only thing to do The only way to properly react was to allow oneself, like a tablet in warm water, to dissolve. In the mornings, Tristan woke me gently at the desk by placing her warm hand on my cheek. I don't know if this is how she woke her brother, Arthur, but that was her way with me. My discomfort, sleeping in a seated position at the writing desk, after Arthur's fashion, had been replaced by a learned sense of appreciation. I had never realized that one could find any adequate repose in any position other than the traditional flatback. But I found, after a few nights' initial rejection, that sleeping in the desk chair, with my face on a small soft pillow on the desk, was quite refreshing. After breakfast on the balcony, I would read for an hour or so from whatever volume Tristram handed me. Because I never saw the same book twice, I began reading from the books without any concern for order. I just opened the books at random and read them with the most mild form of attention. I was not bored reading the books, despite not really following whatever narrative I was reading. I would read until I found, again, Tristram's warm hand upon my face. Originally, I had met these face touchings with a start, leaping practically from my chair as though struck by a plank. But now, with use, I found her hand upon my cheek to be the most entirely right way to terminate an activity, whether it was reading, writing, or sleeping, and I met her touch with, I hoped, an agreeable smile. Lunch came early, at around 11, and this was followed at noon or so by a brief nap on the balcony. We would bring blankets over our laps and raise our feet on the ottomans and gaze out over the trees or down at the folk in the street, and we would both drift off for an hour or so. Everything during the day was experienced in these hour or so installments. Naps, eating, writing, reading. When writing time came, instead of laboring at the typewriter where my opening sentence of the book I was apparently about to write stared like a lizard from the dead page, I simply scribbled in the notepad that I used to communicate with Tristram. After a time, I realized I was creating a kind of utterly boring poem. It began, "First you let go of the rain, and when you've let go of the rain, you let go of the clouds. And when you've let go of the clouds, you let go of the sky." The line itself about letting go of the rain I'd lifted from Tristram's first enigmatic note to me. I had written it down, hoping to fight some meaning from it. But instead, I used it as a template for an endlessly easy poem that was simply a long chain of letting go of this and that, and with each release, finding the next thing that could be let go of. After a week or so of this, I began to wonder whether there would ever be a real end to the poem, or whether it was just like a little bird that went picking up berries here and there and dropping them off elsewhere in order to pick up others. After my writing session, it was time for our second nap. This was an inside nap that took place on the sofas in the main living room. I did not usually sleep during this nap, but instead relaxed deeply into my daze, into a state that I determined later must be quite close to that of meditation. This state was achieved partly due to the fact that just prior to this second nap, I was usually presented with my enigmatic note. I don't know how much time had passed. It might have been a week, it might have been a month, or longer. But one afternoon, as we settled down in the couches for our second nap, I extended my hand to accept Tristram's pre-nap riddle. I opened it, expecting to find some unfathomable phrase that I might ponder for the next hour or so, but was surprised to read the following. "I know that you've been working on a poem. I would like you to read it to me aloud. I know that you have not finished it. You will finish it today as you read it." I stared at her for a moment, still half swallowed in the expected mood of mystery. But I finally stood and went into the main study to fetch the handful of little note cards, upon which I'd written my strange verses. As I sat back down and readied myself to read, I felt the sharpness of my uncomfortability. I would have almost preferred to stand naked before her than to show her my voice. And as I began to recite, it was as though I was seated beside her, listening to the man across the way clear his throat and begin to read. "First you let go of the rain, and when you've let go of the rain, you let go of the clouds. And when you've let go of the clouds, you let go of the sky. And when you've let go of the sky, you let go of the stars. And when you've let go of the stars, you let go of the sun. And when you've let go of the sun, you let go of the moon. And when you've let go of the moon, you let go of the sea. And when you've let go of the sea, you let go of the wind. And when you've let go of the wind, you let go of the trees. And when you let go of the trees, you let go of the forest." I put the cards down as I came to the end of what I'd written. I don't know why, but I found myself standing up. I stood for a moment and listened. Something occurred and then went back, and I heard my voice filling the room and finishing the poem impromptu. "And when you've let go of the forest, you let go of the stream. And when you've let go of the stream, you let go of the fish. And when you've let go of the fish, you let go of the birds. And when you let go of the birds, you let go of the air. And when you've let go of the air, you let go of the earth. And when you let go of the earth, you let go of me. And when you let go of me, you let go of you. And that's how you let go of the rain." Thank you. You've been listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void.